In the U.S., we try to tell students that learning is fun and easy. Well, learning's not fun and easy. We sell them a lie in that case. Whereas in other countries, in particular like Japan, they'll say, actually, learning is hard and it's suffering and you feel really confused. And they teach the children that from the time they're in kindergarten and first grade.
Okay, come and join the suffering. Feel the pain. This is The Science Show. The Science Show on RN, where listening is for masochists, but it does you good. Let's join James Stigler at the University of California, Los Angeles. He's a psychologist and is here to help with maths. What's a psychologist doing with maths?
Trying to figure out how people learn it, which is not that easy. And then also, what's the most effective way to teach it? So there's a long tradition of psychologists studying teaching and learning, and I pretty much fit into that tradition.
I have a friend called Brian Butterworth, who's at University College London, who publishes material about how many people in the population are in some ways psychologically innumerate. In other words, their brains don't work with numbers. It's only about 4%, leaving 90-odd percent who should be. Is that surprising as a figure?
It's not surprising, but I think 90-odd percent of people think they're innumerate. I think
that's the point,
problem. Yeah, it's not that they are innumerate, but they really believe they can't do math for various reasons, mainly because at some point they were socialized to believe that math is something you either can do or you can't. So as soon as they met their first challenge in mathematics, that was all the evidence they need to realize, oh, I'm not a math person. I can't do that. So then they began to steer clear of math.
Jim Stigler and Brian Butterworth is now back at the University of Melbourne. The name for the maths blindness is called dyscalculia, and that's the name of his book.
There's a group of people who we call dyscalculics, and these are people who find it very difficult to learn arithmetic. It's rather like dyslexia. It's something you're born with, and it's something that, as far as we know, you can compensate for, but you don't recover from. But it's a serious problem, and it affects over 5% of the people, so it's nearly a million Australians. Now, one of the indicators is an inability to represent fingers mentally. So they have, a vague representation of their fingers, whereas people who are good at maths usually have a rather precise representation of their fingers. Now, this has been known for about 60 or 70 years, and it's quite easy to test for. Now, it turns out that one of the parts of the brain that controls finger representation is in the parietal lobe, and Josef Gerstmann, a long time ago, discovered that if you had a lesion in a particular part of the left parietal lobe, known as the angular gyrus, you would have both impaired representations of your fingers and also impaired calculation. People have argued about this for a long time. Is the connection between fingers and numbers just like an accident of neuroanatomy, or is it functional? It's kind of peculiar that in people who don't use their fingers to count, I mean, I don't use my fingers to count, except when I'm trying to work out how many days car rental I have to pay for. But apart from that, you know, if I have to do 5 plus 3, I don't do it on my fingers anymore. But nevertheless, we found that if you disabled this part of the brain temporarily using a technique called transcranial magnetic stimulation, then this would affect both their finger representation and also their numerical representation. And we thought that this showed that there was something rather functional about the relationship between these two capacities, even in adults who no longer use their fingers to do calculation with.
Brian Butterworth is working on maths and fingers at the University of Melbourne with Bob Reeve. Brian's book, just out, is Dyscalculia, From Science to Education, published by Routledge. And so back to psychologist James Stigler at UCLA. How do countries compare? You've studied them, haven't you?
Yeah, we've looked at mathematics teaching all over the world. The U.S. does not do very well. Australia does a little bit better. But the top performing countries are countries like Japan, the Netherlands, China, Hong Kong, Switzerland.
What's their secret?
Well, interestingly, if you look superficially, like, oh, do they work in groups or do they work individually? Do they use the blackboard or do they use manipulatives or do they do it all with symbols? You'll not find a pattern. But if you dig a little deeper, we believe we've identified three characteristics or features of the learning opportunities that enable them to learn math deeply. And they're pretty obvious, really. The first one is productive struggle. In the U.S., we try to tell students that learning is fun and easy. Well, learning's not fun and easy. We sell them a lie in that case. Whereas in other countries, in particular like Japan, they'll say, actually, learning is hard and it's suffering and you feel really confused. And they teach the children that from the time they're in kindergarten and first grade. So when they meet their first challenge, they think, oh, this is what learning feels like. Kind of like if we go to the gym and we get sore, we don't say, oh, I'm not a gym person. I better not do that anymore. We think that's part of getting in shape. And they've been able to figure out how to socialize their students to believe that. So like anything else, if you don't struggle and suffer to a certain extent, you can't learn math. And to the extent we try to take that out of the instruction, our students aren't going to learn math.
I'm just going to tell you a little story before asking you about the other two, because that reminds me very much of a head of a school. She was actually teaching maths to Indigenous kids who'd often had pretty rough times. You know, they were there in school because there was nowhere else to go. And she told them, I'm going to teach you algebra, but you won't get it. It's just too hard. And it's the kind of thing that you've got to have a brilliant brain to do, but I'll go through it because it's in the curriculum, but you just won't. And they were so incensed by that, they all knuckled down and they got prizes, all of them. It's amazing. Yeah. I hope that doesn't surprise you.
Well, I'd have to know her, but I think she probably had them in the palm of her hand.
Exactly.
Yes.
And what about the other two examples?
Well, first of all, if you just struggle and you don't have anyone introducing you to the conceptual structure of math, it's very hard to learn it on your own. So there's a lot of evidence that pure discovery learning doesn't really work. But if you get people to struggle and then you provide them with some explicit access to the underlying structure of mathematics so that they can understand it deeply, that's the next feature. And that's really, really important. And there's a favorite quote I have, which is not exactly this, but it's from Confucius in China. And he said, if I have not driven a student wild to distraction, where they absolutely are pulling their hair out, they can't stand it because they can't figure something out. If you're not at that level, you're not ready to be taught. But once a student gets to that level, then I can teach them the lesson. And I think that's a great model. You want the students to struggle with important math problems, and then you want to step in when they're really going to be grateful for any help you can give them, and that's great instruction.
And what's the third?
The third is just doing this over and over again. It's this idea of deliberate practice. I'm sure you may have heard something about the literature and expertise, 10,000 hours. And it's not repetitive practice. Many times you go to a math classroom and they say, I taught you to do this one type of problem. Now do 50 of them. And they're all identical. You're not learning anything from doing 50. But if each one is different from the one before and is more complex or covers a different territory or requires the coordination of some different knowledge, then you're actually broadening your understanding.
What about the tyranny of perfection? Because an awful lot of people who are discussing things, as you are in Australia, have disputed the fact that there is only one correct answer, and unless you get it, you fail, because the journey there is rather more important than doing the king hit,
right,
which is total failure or total success. Is that something that you've looked at as well?
Well, often there is one correct answer, but there are many ways to get to that answer. And I think that's one of the most important things about math. If the enemy of understanding is teaching someone the steps, if you say, step one, do this, step two, step three, as soon as you're following steps, you've stopped trying to figure out what makes sense in this situation. And you're not going to come up with a novel method in a new situation. So I think the key is, again, letting people try to figure out problems themselves and then sharing alternatives. If you just take a class of students, and they do this in Japan all the time, and say, here's a hard problem, work on it. First of all, our students won't work on it because they'll say, well, you didn't teach us how to do it yet. So what are you trying to pull here? But the Japanese students will just get to work. And because no one taught them the steps, of course they come up with many different ways to solve the problem. And then they're very interested to see what other students came up with. And then a skillful teacher can look across all those methods and say, why do they all work? And why does that one not work? And that's how you get down to the mathematical structure. And it's very gratifying.
I'm going to ask you a question that I asked somebody who's actually a maths teacher in a school in Queensland, who's in charge in a university of organising camps where kids can go in and spend a few days with people who know about maths and somehow suss it out. But I asked her what she does in a classroom if she's standing at the board and she's trying to work out the answer to a problem and not getting it or getting it wrong. How do you deal yourself with
that happens to
failure?
All the time, because I teach statistics to university students and some programming using software to do data analysis. And I literally put a screen up in the front and I say, let's see if we can figure this out. And sometimes I can't. But I have a class of 250 students, and you can guarantee that some of them can figure it out. So they just shout at me. And I also tell them, gee, if I forget what the command is to do something, I usually Google it and see if I can find it that way. So let's give it a try, and I'll Google it. And of course, what you realize is you have to know something to be able to interpret what comes back in a Google search. Mm-hmm. And that's really what I want my students to learn. I don't want them to memorize a whole bunch of commands. I want them to know what a function is, and if they can't remember it, how they might find it, and then how they would identify which is the right one.
You said in the beginning that the standard in American schools ain't what it should be. Any idea what's going to work putting that right? And are the young people worried themselves about the fact that they're not getting the results they might?
I don't think they're that worried. If they've been taught somehow that the key is to memorize everything and then be able to put it on the test and to get an A, to convince them that that's not what you want them to do is very, very difficult. They don't really believe you. In my course, I spend time at the beginning trying to tell them that you cannot memorize what I want you to learn in this class. You have to understand it. And then at the end of the class, I ask them how much memorization was required. I do an exit survey. And there's quite a distribution. Some people say none. Other people say a lot. But one thing we found is the people who think a lot of memorization was required, they score significantly more poorly on the final exam. So they never really adapt that mindset, this idea that what's important is to understand what's going on, not to remember anything that I say.
And for those who are listening who are young and struggling with maths, are you convinced that for most of them, for most of us for that matter, if we knuckle down, we can get successes and it's worth trying?
Absolutely. But you have to find someone who's a teacher who also thinks that you can figure it out. And if they think their job is just to teach you the steps, then it's going to be very hard. You not only have to learn math, but you have to teach the teacher what kind of help you need. And again, we've done research with community college students who are failing at math. We have a big problem in this country. 60% of all the students nationwide who go to community college, they graduate high school, go to community college, they take a placement test, and they are not qualified to take a college math class, even though they graduated high school. And then if you ask those students, what's the problem? What does your teacher need to do to help you? The most common answer is they need to break it down into smaller steps so that I can write every step down. So the students really are lacking the metacognition they need to help them figure out how to have a more productive mindset about math. My own opinion is that if they can figure out something on their own, and if you can coax them to a point where they do that, that's the only way you can convince them that it's possible. And then I think some can go on and find that that's very rewarding. And I'm seeing that in my statistics class. But I see it not by teaching them math, but by teaching them R, which is a programming language, because it's not math. So they look at it and they go, oh, well, that's not math. Maybe I can do that. And it turns out they can do that. It's hard, and they have to struggle, and they get things wrong. But it doesn't paralyze them. You know, so many of the students have math trauma in their background. And it's just very hard for them to overcome that.
You mentioned teacher, and I mentioned before the name Eddie Woo, W-O-O. And any listeners who've not heard of this superhero, who's actually won major national awards, do you have an Eddie Wu here in the United States?
Well, we have had Eddie Wus, and we probably have a lot of Eddie Wus. I think that's what's interesting about the way we view teaching is it's a very idiosyncratic thing and a very personal thing. So great teachers, we tend to think of that more as a personality thing and something that somebody figured out. What I think we need to do is shift and depersonalize teaching and begin to look at what are the methods that every teacher could use that would help students learn more. So in a way, I think would I like to see Eddie Wu teach? I would love that. I would kill to go see him teach. But is that the way to solve the problem? Probably not, because if a teacher looks at Eddie Wu, probably the first thing they're going to think is, ah, I could never do that. He's amazing. I could never do that. And instead, we want to depersonalize it and say, oh, if you look what he's doing, it's actually those same three features. That's what he's doing. You may have to do that a different way, but that's what he's doing.
Jim Stigler is professor of psychology at the University of California, Los Angeles. And here is Eddie Wu, who also has a new book.
Really, this is the overflow of all the things I learned about mathematics as a teacher that I never knew and I wished I'd known when I was a student. I didn't particularly like maths when I was a kid. And when I started to teach this subject, the typical question that I get asked is, so why are we learning this? What's the point? When am I going to use this in my life? I wanted good answers to those questions. And the answers I came up with, they formed the book. The main audience that I had in my mind, the person I was sitting across from and I pictured as I wrote, was, I guess, what I would call a mathematically disenfranchised adult. Someone who probably, going the way through school, maybe had some success early on, but then when they met all those X's and Y's or calculus or something like that, it just became too hard. And I meet so many people who, in their grown adult life, they've just said, you know what, I've just closed that door. I've never been able to get past a certain hurdle in mathematics, and I just think I'm not a math person. And part of my own journey has been coming from that point of view and then realizing, actually, no, I think all of us, every single human being, is capable of much more mathematics than we probably give ourselves credit for. It's that person who maybe doubts themselves a little bit that I wrote the book for.
And the book is Wu's Wonderful World of Maths. More from him later. Well, so far we've heard from lots of countries, or about them, but not from Russia, with its own traditions. Harvard mathematician Tom Lehrer has some guidance.
Who made me the genius I am today? The mathematician that others all quote? Who's the professor that made me that way? The greatest that ever got chalk on his coat. One man deserves the credit, one man deserves the blame, and Nikolai Ivanovich Lobachevsky is his name. Hi, Nikolai Ivanovich Lobachevsky. I am never forget the day I first meet the great Lobachevsky. In one word, he told me the secret of success in mathematics. Plagiarize. Plagiarize. Let no one else's work evade your eyes. Remember why the good Lord made your eyes, so don't shade your eyes, but plagiarize, plagiarize, plagiarize. Only be sure always to call it, please, research. And ever since I meet this man, my life is not the same. And Nikolai Ivanovich Lobachevsky is his name. Hi, Nikolai Ivanovich Lobachevsky. I am never forget the day I'm given first original paper to write. It was on analytic and algebraic topology of local Euclidean metrization of infinitely differentiable Riemannian manifold. Boże moi. This I know from nothing. What I'm going to do. I think of great Lobachevsky and I get idea. I have a friend in Minsk who has a friend in Pinsk, whose friend in Omsk has friend in Tomsk with friend in Akmolinsk. His friend in Alexandrovsk has friend in Petropavlovsk, whose friend somehow is solving now the problem in Dniepropetrovsk. And when his work is done, ha-ha, begins the fun. From Dniepropetrovsk to Petropavlovsk, by way of Ilyisk and Novorossiysk, to Alexandrovsk, to Akmolinsk, to Tomsk, to Omsk, to Pinsk, to Minsk, to me the news will run. Yes, to me the news will run. And then I write by morning, night, and afternoon, and pretty soon my name in Dniepropetrovsk is cursed. When he finds out, I publish first. And who made me a big success and brought me wealth and fame? Nikolai Ivanovich Lobachevsky is his name. Hi, Nikolai Ivanovich Lobachevsky. I am never forget the day My first book is published. Every chapter I stole from somewhere else. Index I copy from old Vladivostok telephone directory. This book was sensational. Pravda. Well, Pravda said Gilbil Kalorika dat prinyam lachajila. It stinks. But Izvestia. Izvestia said, Ya idu kuda sam tsar idiot peshkom. It stinks. Metro Goldwyn Moskva buys the movie rights for 6 million rubles, changing title to The Eternal Triangle, with Ingrid Bergman playing part of Hypotenuse. And who deserves the credit? And who deserves the blame? Nikolai Ivanovich Lobachevsky is his name.
Tom Lehrer at Harvard